loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, this morning, the Trump administration issued sanctions against seven Russian oligarchs and 12 companies they own or control and 17 senior Russian government officials. The Trump administration says that the new sanctions are a response to what they call interference by the Russian government in the 2016 election. But where's the evidence about this meddling? Then, our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming midterm elections, the 2018 elections, we take a look at special elections in Wisconsin and Arizona, a Republican primary in West Virginia, and the crucial Senate race in Tennessee.
But before we get to sanctions against Russian oligarchs, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, for a second Friday in a row, Israeli forces are killing Palestinians for protesting for the right to return to their land. At least seven Palestinians have been killed today already, with another 700 plus wounded. One of the dead is a 16-year-old boy, and at least 31 children have been wounded as Israel refuses to change its open fire rules and pummels the protesters with live ammunition and high-velocity bullets. Next, Saeed Vassal was well-known to residents and police alike in his Brooklyn, New York neighborhood as a harmless, mentally ill man who danced on the sidewalks and played with all types of items that he found on the street. But 2 days ago, someone allegedly called 911 to report that Vassal was pointing something that looked like a gun at passersby. It wasn't a gun, it was a showerhead. Police arrived, and within 6 seconds, Vassal was shot and killed. The community is furious and has been rising up in protest. Then, thousands of Arizona teachers took to the streets yesterday, threatening to go on strike if the state legislature doesn't improve teacher pay and working conditions, reduce class sizes, and purchase new textbooks and equipment. Teachers in Arizona are among the worst paid in the country. And then 3,100 employees of Google have signed a letter protesting the company's involvement in a Pentagon program that uses artificial intelligence to interpret video imagery that could be used to improve the targeting of drone strikes, or what Secretary of Defense James Mattis calls the lethality of the U.S. military. And finally, we continue our conversation of yesterday about Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and personal data. Did Cambridge Analytica impact the 2016 election? And in other headlines, disgraced former South Korean President Park Hyun-yi was sentenced to 24 years in prison today on corruption charges, in addition to being hit with a $16 million fine. Former President Park was forced to resign following demonstrations referred to as the Candlelight Revolution. Park was a right-wing hardliner who opposed dialogue with the North, and her ouster was a major factor in the victory of the pro-peace current president Moon Jae-in. President Trump announced that he was considering another $100 billion in tariffs against China. China's taking action against the United States at the World Trade Organization in the country's latest move to hit back in the trade war initiated by the Trump administration. China filed a complaint arguing that the tariffs imposed by the U.S. are illegal. The tariffs were imposed under the authority of Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act, which has been the subject of international controversy in other cases in the past. After the Brazilian Supreme Court ruled that former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was not eligible to delay his prison sentence during his appeals process, an arrest warrant was issued and he was given until late today to present himself to police. This warrant is despite his rights to additional legal steps, and his arrest order was not expected for another week or two. Workers in Brazil have surrounded the metalworkers' union offices to protect Lula from arrest. Protests have erupted in support across the country. In reaction to the teacher strikes, the Oklahoma Senate is discussing a tax bill today. The package includes hotel taxes, gambling taxes, and an internet sales tax, and the latter has been approved by the House already. This is while tens of thousands of teachers have come to the Capitol building during strikes for increased pay, better facilities, and materials and resources for the students. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the sanctions against Russian oligarchs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Trump administration's announcement that it is imposing new sanctions on Russia. This morning, the Trump administration issued sanctions on seven Russian oligarchs and 12 companies they own or control, and 17 senior Russian government officials, which the administration is saying is due to election meddling. But where's the evidence about that meddling? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and a political commentator and the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And he is now the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. And from Grantham, UK, by Alexander Mercuris, the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Joe and Alexander, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian.
Delighted to be with you.
Thank you both. Joe Loria, I'm looking at a statement by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, or is it Mnuchin?
I don't know. I think it's Mnuchin.
Okay.
I think.
Let's call him Mnuchin. I want to read his quote because, well, he didn't mean to be ironic, but to me, it's dripping with irony coming from him as the Secretary of Treasury. The Russian government operates for the disproportionate benefit of oligarchs and government elites. Russian oligarchs and elites who profit from this corrupt system will no longer be insulated from the consequences of their government's destabilizing activities. That's the quote. Well, I don't know. Joe Loria, I thought it was dripping with irony. I mean, this is a government of oligarchs here in Washington. They're operating a corrupt system. And of course, they intend to be insulated from the consequences of their government's destabilizing activities because they consider that just to be business as usual. Anyway, go ahead, Joe.
That quote by Mnuchin, whatever his pronunciation is, I pulled that out. I saw that. That's an extraordinary example of psychological projection. For him to talk about a government that operates for the benefit of oligarchs and government elites, obviously, that is, unfortunately, the system that's developed here in the United States. In addition to that, he went on to say that Russia engages in a range of malign activities around the globe. I mean, who has engaged in more malign activities around the globe since the end of the Second World War than the United States of America? So this is one more case of the United States defending its actions from its people by blaming someone else for many of the things they do themselves. These sanctions obviously were intended for economic reasons. For example, they may help American companies and competitors and Western companies against these 12 companies that are going to be sanctioned that are owned by the 7 of the oligarchs. And it also, of course, has a political dimension to it that I'm sure we're going to discuss more here now. They're clearly trying to circle around and tighten a noose around Vladimir Putin by not going directly at him, but trying to go around the people that they think are very close to him, with the ultimate aim, of course, of trying for regime change in Russia. I don't think there's any doubt that this is what's behind that. In addition to that, Reuters had an interesting quote here saying that Trump had been under fire for not taking strong action against Russia. And that's also from Republicans, of course. The key part is the sanctions could complicate his hopes for good relations with Putin. I think obviously that is something the establishment on both sides of the aisle do not want because of their ultimate goals in Russia. So this is another reason for these sanctions, to stop Trump from doing the sensible thing and bring about detente.
Alexander, your take.
Well, I agree with all of that, and I'm going to add something else, which is I think that it shows, not for the first time, a fundamental misunderstanding of how the Russian political system works. Because if you look at what Mnuchin says, he seems to think that these people, these oligarchs, as they are always called, are people who are somehow in control of the Russian government. And the assumption seems to be that if we can come after them and make life difficult for them, they will do things for us in Russia by changing the government, by getting rid of Mr. Putin, who's causing us all this trouble, and by changing the policy of Russia more in the direction of what the United States wants. Now, I have to say, that may have been true. That may have been the case 20 years ago, but it is simply not the case now. To assume that people like, say, Mr. Deripaska or Mr. Miller, to the oligarchs, to the business people who have been sanctioned, are people who are in a position to change Russian policy or who are in a position to change the Russian government, is simply wrong. And it is what he's actually doing is that it is, in fact, strengthening the position of Mr. Putin because, one, these people become more dependent on him, and two, to the extent that they have been independent forces in Russia, these oligarchs, their degree of independence and autonomy is being undermined. So it is actually strengthening the political system rather than weakening it. So though I completely agree with all the things that Joe Lawrie said, I think we have to add that extra dimension as well.
I think that's important, John, because I agree with Alexander. This is a big, I mean, it might play well in the media, but it's, and as Joe is saying, they're trying to tighten the noose around Putin for sure. But it's a mistake in policy because Putin has been arguing for the last 15 years to all of these oligarchs, don't keep putting all of your money in the West. Don't put it in London. Don't put it in villas in Paris. Don't put it in the United States. Don't Miami real estate. Don't do that. Put it here. He's trying to force and discipline the capitalist class that emerged after the fall of the Soviet Union and force them into a different kind of regime than the regime that existed in the 90s. And he's been going at that all the time. So if anything, I think Alexander's right. I think if anything, from the point of view of strengthening or weakening Putin, this will strengthen Putin. And also in public opinion, as we could see from the recent election, it also strengthens Putin because the Russians feel they are being targeted.
Oh, I couldn't agree anymore. I think that politically, this pushes them closer to Putin. And economically, you're right. This sends a signal to every would-be investor in the world that if we don't like your politics, we're going to steal your money. And so what are you going to do? You're going to invest somewhere else, not here. I have a question for Joe Lauria, too. We have the names of these oligarchs. As Alexander said, Oleg Deripaska, he has close ties to Paul Manafort, Suleiman Karamov, he's a financier, oil executives, Putin's son-in-law, et cetera, et cetera. Have any of these men in any way done harm to the United States? Were they targeted for any reason other than they are perceived to be close to Putin?
Well, first of all, if they were smart, they would have pulled out any money they had inside the U.S., before knowing that this would be coming, or sell off if they had time any property in the U.S. So what harm are they doing? They put money and property in the U.S. No, there's no evidence that there's any harm, but there's no evidence needed in this type of thing, John, as we've seen now with the case of the so-called nerve agent attack, with all the other sanctions going forward. We don't need evidence. It's not based on any court findings or any, even the results of an investigation, even a Mueller's investigation has not targeted these guys who are being sanctioned today. It's purely on the word of intelligence agencies. It's the same old thing. One should also keep in mind the deal that Putin made when he first came to power in the early 2000s with the oligarchs, essentially saying, and I may be simplifying this, that if you stay out of politics, you can do what you want. But if you meddle in politics, I'm going to go after you. And he went after several of them and others didn't. So that also tends to prove that if you're going to be an oligarch and survive in Putin's Russia, you're not going to be getting involved in politics or running the government, as the Secretary of Treasury tried to tell us.
Again, also for our audience, Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, calling the oligarchs running and benefiting from a corrupt system will no longer be insulated from the consequences of their wrongdoing. But let's look at the I just want to go back because the Trump cabinet, I'm looking at Forbes magazine, a magazine that we quote here all the time because, as people know, I'm a socialist. So I want to quote Forbes, which calls itself the capitalist tool, unabashedly, because then nobody can accuse them of being left wing. But I mean, they're looking at they took an assessment of the Trump cabinet. Here's what each member of Trump's $4.5 billion cabinet is worth. $4.5 billion. We're talking about Steve Mnuchin, Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, Goldman Sachs, he's gone now, Wilbur Ross, Secretary of Commerce, a billionaire, Betsy DeVos, a billionaire, Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, ahead of Secretary of State till recently, he's worth about $500 million, Ben Carson, Ryan Zinke. These people are fabulously rich. Alexander, why don't we call them oligarchs? Is it just maybe it's a language thing?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And if we're talking about these Russian businessmen, they are part of the international capitalist class, of which all the people that you also mentioned in the United States who are part of the United States government, people like Wilbur Ross and Stephen Mnuchin and all the others, they're also part of that capitalist class. And that capitalist class are the friends of the United States, which historically have underpinned and protected the system which makes them rich and which protects their money. That's why Russian oligarchs were investing their money in the United States. And if we come back to the United States, if we look at the whole history of the United States, but if we focus especially on the events since the financial crisis of 2008, what we see is economic policies pursued in the United States, which have made this capitalist class within the United States much richer than it was before 2008, and everybody else is either poorer or is essentially in the same place. So if you are talking about an oligarchy, it is an oligarchy whose primary instrument is the United States and its government and its economic and political institutions. Now, Russia is affected by that, no question. Russia changed its political system radically in the 1990s, and these people emerged there. But it is not its center, and these people, to come back to an earlier question, are not naturally the U.S.'s enemies.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm looking also at the Sputnik News article on our website, which is, you can go to sputniknews.com. It's the Russian Security Council chief slams new U.S. sanctions on businessmen officials. That's not a big surprise. But what the Russian officials are making the argument that the sanctioning of Russia's main arms import-export business is really a form of protectionism, Joe, that they're trying to ice Russia out of the international arms market, the selling of weapons, which unfortunately exists as a major, major market. That the argument that the Russians are making is that part of these new sanctions are just another kind of tariff or another kind of protectionism, but guised as national security. Do you think there's any merit to that?
I do. This is both political and economic intentions behind these sanctions. It hurts the aluminum. It would hurt Russian aluminum, financial and petrochemical industries, because that's what these oligarchs are mainly involved in. And it would help then Western and American companies who compete in that market. And as far as going after the arms industry, this isn't a direct attack on that, but I guess that you could see that in a way, that they're moving in on that as well. And Russia has a large share of the arms market, not as big as the U.S., but in fact, the top five arms dealers in the world happen to be the five permanent members of the Security Council, and Russia is one of them. So yes, I think there's definitely this economic component to this, not just blaming Russia for interfering in the election, all the other things for which we have no evidence yet. It's also, I think, really to clip Trump's wings again, and he's saying he wants to pull American troops out of Syria at this moment, by the way, and he's going up against his general. So there's another effort to undermine him in any effort he has. And I don't know where he got the idea from during the campaign that he wanted better relations with Russia. Could have come from Bannon. The Russiagaters believe it's because Putin has something on him. But even if he does, I would like to see detente. I think any sane person would. But here is the opposition to that coming in the form of sanctions in other ways, that Trump will be undermined in his attempts to build better relations with Russia. I think we have to see it in those terms as well.
Alexander, let's talk about the Skripal case. The daughter, Yulia, for a couple of weeks now, I think she's been out of critical condition. She's talking. She's the daughter. Her father was also poisoned. He appears to be recovering now as well. Big parts of the story are starting to break apart, including the arguments made by Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, foreign minister in the UK, that the British scientific establishment, the chemical weapons establishment, had given him categorical assurances that Novichok's, the agent that the UK government says was involved in the poisoning, was produced and could only have been produced by Russia. And in fact, those experts say, in fact, just the opposite, that they never gave such an assurance, that they don't actually know the precise source of this. But nonetheless, it was a deadly nerve agent. Everybody was supposed to be dead. They're not dead. They're recovering. Yulia's cousin applied for a visa to come and visit her in the UK, and the UK has denied that visa. That's a new twist. Anyway, bring us up to date. You're there. You're in the UK.
It's very much, you know, if I can say, like Russia Gate in miniature. All sorts of extraordinary allegations made by very similar people, in fact, often the same people, which, you know, involving some vast, terrifying Russian conspiracy, which when you actually start to unpack them, begin very rapidly to come apart. Now, we're talking about the recovery of Yulia and Yulia Skripal and Sergei Skripal. It should be said that information has been extracted from the British. They were pushed into confirming that Yulia Skripal was recovering when the Russian authorities started to demand consular access to her and started to threaten legal action. They had to admit that Sergei Skripal was recovering when Yulia Skripal telephoned her cousin in Russia and actually said so, and said he's recovering, and that started to trigger more questions. So the British are losing control of the narrative. And if you follow the mainstream media here in Britain, you are seeing huge recriminations about this, with Boris Johnson being blamed for having, as they said, made mistakes. Let us be very clear, those were not mistakes. Those are outright falsehoods that he had spread about the provenance of the chemical agent and about the proof about that provenance. So there's recriminations about that. And there's also, and again, this is very like Russiagate, more and more leaks from the intelligence agencies attempting to try to reinforce a narrative which is collapsing. And when I say it is collapsing, you can see also, if you go beyond the mainstream media and start looking at threads and social media and comments and listen to what people are saying in pubs and bars all over the country, there are growing doubts and people are starting to ask questions and people are starting to wonder. And I think in some respects, people are a bit more critical about these stories in Britain than they are in the US. So I think this thing is only at the beginning, and we could very well see, if it continues to unravel, a political crisis too.
I wondered about that, actually, because here in the States, most people are just accepting this hook, line, and sinker. Friends and relatives of mine included, they just believe it because our leaders are telling us to believe it. And I wondered if the situation was the same or similar in the UK, or if people and the British media is actually beginning to question some of these conclusions that have been presented without any real evidence behind them.
I think if you go to mainstream media, if you go to the big newspapers, the big established newspapers, The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph, The Independent, The Financial Times, you're not going to see much debate there. If you go to social media, and Britain now has a very active social media, then you will see people being much more questioning. And I mean, someone like Craig Murray, for example, who has been at the forefront of doubting this story, is now getting an awful lot of attention. And even what you might call establishment mainstream media is beginning to acknowledge that fact. The fundamental difference, the very big difference between the United States and Britain, is that within Britain, you have in the Labour Party a political leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who stands outside the establishment. And he stands outside the establishment from a position of opposition. I don't feel that Donald Trump ultimately is an opposition. He has certain ideas about a detente with Russia, which Joe Lauria was talking about. But fundamentally, he is part of the U.S. elite. Jeremy Corbyn is not a part of the British elite. In fact, the British elite detests him. But he would not be where he is if there were not an awful lot of people in Britain who think as he does and who support him and who have supported him through all the various crises that he has experienced since he became Labour leader. Now, he is articulating those doubts that people have because he is the leader of the opposition and the leader of the Labour Party, those doubts are more widely distributed than doubts about Russiagate would be in the U.S., and people are picking up on them.
Joe Lauria, Alexander's right about that. That's a big difference between the U.K. and over here. The fact that we have Corbyn in the U.K. We talked to Alexander a week ago. When Corbyn was asking for proof, they were yelling at him like, traitor, traitor. I mean, like he was had done something awful by asking for proof. Now the so-called proof is turning out, again, not to be proof. Just like, you know, the proof about chemical weapons in Iraq in 2003 turned out not to be true. It's so important for people to just stop and think and wait and see the evidence. But of course, the nature of politics in the United States, and absent an opposition like Jeremy Corbyn, if you demand that you want time to think or ask questions or challenge or see the proof, you're just labeled a witch hunt. So there's all this self-censorship that goes on because everybody knows this to be true.
I think there's a big difference with the WMD story. That took many of us were skeptical of that from the beginning, but for the general public, it took years for it to be acknowledged that that was a lie. This is collapsing within weeks of these allegations in the Skripal case. And I think we possibly are at we're perhaps going to be facing here a very extraordinary moment where the spell might be broken that the establishment in Britain and the press there and the inside the United States too could be broken. If this could be turned around, if Johnson has to resign, let's say, if the established press in Britain really begins to show that this was a pack of lies and what the reasons were for those lies, that will filter over here into the United States as well and could undermine even some of the Russiagaters who are faced with the same kind of skepticism here by a few of us that these were based on falsehoods. So I think this could be just we need a moment like this where this is, as I say, this spell is broken that they have over the public about these allegations against Russia without evidence. I'm hoping that that could happen. It might not, but I think this is really extraordinary how quickly and how publicly this is collapsing in Britain.
The problem is that I see is that as soon as this story does collapse, you can, in America at least, you can change the story. The story now becomes the sanctions imposed against all of these Russian government agents, Russian oligarchs and Russian companies. And so then the news of the poisoning and the unraveling of that story in the UK gets sort of pushed off the headlines and pushed off the media.
Right.
With
which
today's
is what they
announcement,
want.
Today's announcement doesn't mean anything really, but it just changes the subject.
No, I'm just going to say, if this collapses in a big way in Britain, the story of the poisoning, I think that that would undermine belief in Russiagate and other things that the American government said. At least that's my hope.
And that's what we hope, because we're fighting this fight every day. And we're telling people, I am anyway, that if you don't stand up to the witch hunt, like too many did not stand up to the witch hunt in the 1940s and 50s, if it's convenient for you or for opportunist reasons or you don't want to be hit or you don't want to lose your friends, if you can't stand up, then you're part of the witch hunt. You leave it open. And the only way a witch hunt ends is when, one, the truth comes out, and two, people are not afraid to tell the truth and stand up for the truth. So I agree with you. I think this is, you know, our hope is that we have people who are steadfast, who are fighting, who are not bowed by this and can utilize these facts. Anyway, John Kiriakou, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Joe Lauria. He's a journalist. He's a political commentator and the author of the book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And he is now the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. Congratulations on that. You're replacing an amazing, important journalist, Robert Perry, who passed away recently in a shocking, ill-timed death. So, Joe Lauria, congratulations on that. And we've been joined from the UK by Alexander McCurris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. On our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming elections, We take a look at special elections in Wisconsin and Arizona, a nasty Republican primary in West Virginia, and the crucial Senate race in Tennessee, among other things. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
I'll tell you, we have so much political news this week that we're going to have to, I guess, keep it tight because it's all important, and I hope we can talk about all of it. Let's start with that special election for a Supreme Court seat in Wisconsin. Now, normally, none of us would pay any attention to an election like this, but it was Governor Scott Walker, the far-right governor of Wisconsin, who made this race an issue. Because he said that this was a bellwether of what the midterm elections were going to look like. And it was a pretty clear-cut race ideologically in that the Democratic candidate is very progressive and the Republican candidate is very conservative. And so there's nothing in the middle. Well, the Democrat won. And Walker, to his credit, I suppose, came out the next day and said that this is a disaster for the Republican Party, that it portends what might be a Democratic wave in this coming midterm election. Let's start with Abdus. Would you agree?
Well, I think he's right. And I think we've been seeing this trend across the country. I mean, we talked about Pennsylvania. We've seen what happened there. And so, I think the tea leaves, he's reading the tea leaves pretty correctly, in my opinion.
And Wisconsin is one of those states in the congressional elections where there is some sway. Democrats win it all sometimes. Republicans win it all other times. And it is a purple state. Whether the Democrats want to admit that or not, it did go for Donald Trump the last time.
Yeah. And unfortunately, or fortunately for the Democrats, Donald Trump's brand, that's interesting that I would say that because Donald Trump, all he is a brand. There's no ideology behind Trump.
Right.
He's just a brand. But his brand is so badly tarnished that even establishment Republicans, even Tea Party-esque Republicans like Scott Walker are coming out and saying, yeah, this is not going to go well for us. And that portends a really bad midterm season for the Republicans. I think
it does. Not to change the subject, but when you have a situation like what we saw today, this morning, when the president announced his intention to impose another $100 billion in tariffs on China. Mm-hmm. And then a Republican senator, Ben Sasse from Nebraska, comes out and says, and he uses the word insane, yes, that the president is insane,
yes,
for doing this. Yeah, I think that does portend some problems.
And what's really going to hurt the GOP base, and if you want to be more specific, the Tea Party base, the Trumpsters, those that supported Trump, is that the tariffs that the Chinese are throwing back at us is hurting mostly the people who supported Trump.
That is a very important point. CNN said yesterday, they actually showed a map that if you look at what states these tariffs are going to hit specifically, and we're talking about things like soybean farmers and pork farmers, 7 of the 9 states are red states. They're states that went for Donald Trump. And so it's largely these Midwestern farmers who are going to take the brunt of these new sanctions.
Exactly.
And they only have one person to complain about.
It's the president they voted for.
Such a shame that they're not going. Not only are they not going to see the benefit of these storied tax cuts that we all know was just a smokescreen for, you know, welfare for the richest 1%, but now they're going to be punished by Trump's insane. And I agree, it's insane bravado because the Chinese government they're not at all shy about returning salvo for salvo with tariffs.
Right.
They're not going to lose a dime.
No, right. They're not
from this.
And the global economy is not like it was in the past. I mean, you just can't have these old type tariffs, not with the way that the global markets are now and everything is intertwined. So to say that it's insane, yes. I mean, here you're talking about China, which is what, the second largest maybe?
Yeah, it is. Second largest economy in the world.
Yeah. So why would you want to pick a fight with them? It just doesn't make sense.
And frankly, they're swimming in cash, right? Because they have such a huge trade surplus. They're swimming in cash. They buy trillions of dollars worth of U.S. long-term government bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can fight us out on this.
Oh, yes,
they can afford it.
Yes, they can.
Yeah, the Republicans are now fighting a battle on all fronts. They're fighting a battle on the foreign policy front. And so are the Democrats, to be honest. But,
sure they
but
are.
But the Republicans, I think, this is their come-to-Jesus moment, I guess, for what they want their party to be after the midterms. Because this Supreme Court race in Wisconsin portends doom for the Republicans, but it also, I think, shows us where the Democratic Party is acknowledging that it needs to go, and that is further left, further toward progressive policies. And that's incredibly important.
That is a very important point, and that leads us to this next issue, which is the special election for a congressional seat outside of Phoenix, Arizona. Now, this is a district we talked about briefly last week. It's a district that Donald Trump won by 21 percentage points, and it takes in Sun City in Maricopa County, which is the base of support for the former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. So this is some seriously conservative territory. But the Democrat is within striking distance of winning this race, and the Republicans seem to be worried about it enough that they've invested over $400,000 now in RNC and RCCC money, Republican Congressional Campaign Committee money, in addition to what the Republicans have already been able to raise out there. Now, no Democrat has ever won this seat before, but the Republicans seem to be seriously worried that there could be a repeat of what we saw in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, it's a repeat. I was just thinking about that. And the fact that Maricopa County that we talked about, the demographics there, older, conservative,
yes,
retired. I mean, you would figure that this would be a given for the Republican candidate.
Oh, yeah.
But once again, it's an indictment against Trump. It's an indictment against the way that the Republican Party has gone really off the hinges. I mean, not just to the right, but really off the hinges. And a president that really doesn't have a really coherent agenda.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and that's being translated down. People are seeing that. People are seeing that this is an administration that doesn't have a coherent agenda. And they're just not willing to support it.
And, you know, as an aside, and I don't mean to change the subject, but one of the things that always amuses me about people who vote for presidents that they later come to hate is that if you look back at the campaign, they told you exactly what they were going to do. Do you remember right after Trump was inaugurated, there was a man in Indiana, Mexican national. He had married an American woman like 30 years ago, and they had a very successful steakhouse
right
in this small town, whatever it was, Valparaiso, Indiana, mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. Elkhart. It was actually in Elkhart, Indiana. And this guy's been paying his taxes for the last 25 years and, you know, was never in trouble. And every year, because he was here as an undocumented alien, every year he would go to INS and fill out his paperwork. Well, they snatched him.
Mm-hmm.
And they deported him.
Yeah, and people were shocked.
And people were shocked, especially his wife.
Yes.
And his wife said, I can't believe that they took my husband and deported him, because the president said that he wanted to deport the bad hombres.
Right.
Remember
the
that?
Right, the bad hombres. That's
and,
right.
And all I could think was, lady, he told you exactly what he was going to do.
Yes, he did.
In
yes.
the race. He yes. said he was going to scoop all the undocumented workers up and expel them all.
Yes.
So why should we be surprised?
Because we have this bizarre kind of, I don't know if you want to call it amnesia or a moral blind spot, I think, when it comes to American voters, where when politicians use dog whistles, too many people always think, well, they're not talking about the people I know. They're not talking about us. That, you know, when politicians use racially coded language,
right.
or they just come right out and say, look, Mexico, they're not sending their best. They're sending drug dealers and rapists.
Right.
People believe that. No, he's not talking about the Mexican nationals that we know, because
right.
these people are good Americans.
Right. Remember, there's a caravan and they're raping women at numbers never seen before. Right.
Never seen before. He said, none of it is based in any kind of reality whatsoever.
No. Made up out of whole cloth.
Completely. But this is, I think, the exposure that we need in this country, to which we have to recognize that American people are not as well versed in politics as we like to think that we are.
No, indeed.
And this is why very often we fall for dogma. We fall for dog whistles. We fall for campaign ads that aren't true, that don't present actual facts. And we base who we vote for on emotion and what we believe these politicians are saying based on our little world.
And I also believe that the reason why someone in that position wouldn't take Trump's threat of deportation seriously is that a lot of us, and especially immigrants, feel safe within this American ethos of meritocracy. So, yes. So
it's like, good. That's right. A good point.
Yeah. So it's like, if I work hard, I do this and I do that, that would shield me from, you know, those type of things. Cause he's not talking about me. He's talking about MS-13. He's
right.
talking about,
right.
the, you know,
sure.
So, I believe, and I think that as Americans, I think we should be very concerned that no matter how well someone does, that none of that matters. You know, you could still, you know, be snatched up by the government and all your efforts and taxes and all this stuff is just out the window.
Right. I want to turn also to the West Virginia Senate primary, the Republican Senate primary, which has just taken a fascinating turn. There's a former coal mining company executive named Don Blankenship. Blankenship was the CEO of a company at the time of a mining disaster several years ago, and more than a dozen people were killed. He was finally charged with a multitude of felonies. He was found guilty of several felonies and ended up doing, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years in a federal prison, whatever it was.
Club fed. Huh?
Club fed. Yeah, it actually was club fed.
Right.
And he's gotten out. He still has his millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he decided that the best way to clear his name is to run for the United States Senate. And it's funny to me because his position is just to oppose everybody,
right?
He doesn't like Joe Manchin. He doesn't like Donald Trump. He doesn't like the Republicans in the race. He doesn't like anybody. And he's begun running television advertisements in the very, very, like, prohibitively expensive Washington, D.C. media market. Now, the Washington market only covers something like a third or a quarter of southeastern West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It would make more sense to advertise in the cheap local markets, or if you've got the money, in the Pittsburgh market, because you would hit Morgantown from Pittsburgh, and that's really where most West Virginians live.
Mm-hmm.
He's advertised everywhere, Pittsburgh, Washington, locally, southeastern Ohio. He's spending millions of dollars. Well, there's an article in Politico entitled "Trump Wades into Nasty Senate Primary." The president is going to West Virginia not just to work against Don Blankenship, not even just to work for one of the other Republican candidates, but his position is that he's going to endorse both of the other Republican candidates.
Right.
I mean, I've never even heard of anything like this. He doesn't care if it's going to be the state attorney general, Patrick Morrissey, or U.S. representative by the name of Evan Jenkins, just so long as it's not Don Blankenship. Have you ever heard, Jacqueline, anything like this?
I feel like he just set up like a battle of the fittest kind of, you know, a Coliseum fight to the death kind of thing, for whichever one is left standing wins. And that is unheard of. But again, that those are the actions of someone who has no political knowledge, no understanding of politics. But Blankenship does. Yeah. You see, so what Blankenship is doing is he's trying to reform his image to the Washington establishment Republicans.
Absolutely, yes.
To try to get those who are already ticked off at Trump and who just want him to go away but are too afraid to come out and say it. He's trying to get them to back him so that he can have some type of base to stand on against Trump and his two gladiators that he's just unleashed in the Coliseum in West Virginia.
Right. Just so I have my facts straight, in this Politico article, it says that he was the CEO of the company that owned the Upper Big Branch mine.
Mm-hmm.
8 years ago yesterday, there was an explosion in the mine that killed 29 workers.
Wow.
And Blankenship ended up serving 1 year in a minimum security federal prison.
I understand that this is not an aspect of campaign finance reform, but I really feel that if you are the head of a corporation that has created a situation where people have died in your company and you were found liable or culpable in any way, you should never run for office again.
No, and there are other ways to rehabilitate your name.
Yes.
You know, volunteer your time. My God, if you're worth $35 million or whatever it is that he's worth, I've seen $30 and $35 million bandied about. you know, the good works that you could do with that kind of money?
Of amazing. Course.
You know, the children you could educate or provide health care for, or the computers you can buy
especially
for inner city
in West
schools?
Virginia.
Especially in a place like West Virginia.
He could almost single-handedly address the teacher strikes.
He could actually afford the raise in salaries and pensions for the teachers.
He could.
That's absolutely true. I want to talk also about the Tennessee U.S. Senate race. Now, we've got an incumbent senator, Bob Corker. You know, I actually knew him a little bit on Capitol Hill when I was working for John Kerry. Corker was the number two Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was the nicest guy. He's a former car dealer.
There you go.
Owner. Yeah, he owns a lot of car dealerships in the state of Tennessee. But he's a very dapper, very friendly, and then surprisingly well informed kind of guy. Well, he is now in the position of being the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Quite an important position. It's really the most prestigious position or committee on Capitol Hill. But he was also the first to attack Donald Trump once Trump was inaugurated.
That's right.
And, you know, Trump made fun of his stature. Senator Corker's only, I would say he's probably 5'5" or 5'6". He's a very small, thin man. And of course, the president made fun of his physical stature and came up with some nasty nickname for him.
Because that's what presidents do.
Right. It's very presidential. Corker gave it back as well as he took it. Mm-hmm. But then he announced that he just was not running for re-election. And he said what so many of these guys say when they decide not to run, that they just hate the partisan bickering. They can't get anything done. Nobody's friendly to one another. You know, time was in the not too distant past where members of both parties would rent a house and share a house together. You would have these group houses of congressmen on Capitol Hill where four of them are Democrats and four of them are Republicans, and they play cards every night and they make dinner together every night. That just doesn't exist anymore. Those days are over.
We're all old enough to remember during the time of Tip O'Neill. And
absolutely. That's exactly what I was thinking. Yes.
And I mean, and that type of atmosphere doesn't exist anymore on Capitol Hill.
No, the Tip O'Neills and the Bob Michaels of the world are gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're
exactly.
gone. He announced his retirement from the Senate. Now, Tennessee is clearly a red state. It's always, well, not always, but it's been a solidly red state since the days of Ronald Reagan. But here we've got a very popular Democratic governor in Phil Bredesen running against Marsha Blackburn, a Republican congresswoman, who actually is also pretty popular. But according to The Hill newspaper, just this week, Bredesen has opened up a 10 percentage point lead in that Senate race. In the last poll, which was actually a Democratic poll, so a lot of people thought, well, maybe it's biased in favor of Bredesen, it showed only a 5 percentage point lead for him. Now, in this apolitical poll, really, it's showing a 10 percentage point race. This was done by Middle Tennessee State University. So it's 45 for Bredesen and 35 for Blackburn. 17% are unsure. So it's still a race. You know, that magic number is 50%. But do you think that the Democrats could actually win this Senate seat?
That's hard to say, but I think I feel about Bob Corker retiring the way I felt about Olympia Snow leaving.
You know, you say, doggone it, there goes one of the adults in the room.
Exactly. There goes another adult in the room, even though I didn't agree with all of Corker's policies, certainly not, because he was well-informed, because he was not always necessarily dogmatic and didn't return the party line and the talking points, and you could have a conversation with them.
You really could.
And get down to the meat of the issue and still disagree, but at least you had an intellectual exchange with the man, and he could back up his opinion with thoughts, with ideas, and with facts. Still disagree, but at least you knew there was a brain there. There was a heart behind that.
And the thing about him, on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he was very much cut from the same cloth as Dick Lugar, who was another moderate, a long time senator, Republican from Indiana, and very highly respected in the area of foreign affairs. Well, much to everybody's shock, Dick Lugar lost a Republican primary to a very far right insurgent who then lost to a Democrat in the general election. But it was Lugar that really taught Corker bipartisanship, at least in foreign policy.
Right.
And so when he became chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, it was really in the mold of Dick Lugar.
Right.
Yeah.
But we're going to lose that now. And Senator Risch from Idaho, who's very, very conservative. I mean, he's known for his hard right attitude on a lot of issues, including foreign policy, is the top Republican once Corker leaves.
Wow. I was thinking about when the question that you asked about can the Democrat win in Tennessee. I think that there's a possibility. I know that the Republican is also popular. But again, if I'm not mistaken, this may be related in some way, but the demographics in Tennessee are changing.
Indeed.
You know, you have a large surges of Hispanics coming into the area.
Same in North Carolina.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's going to be a big plus for the Democrats, because with Trump and the anti-immigrant stance and everything else, Republicans, no matter who you are, got aware of that. So if you're running somewhere where there's a large Latino Hispanic population, well, you know, you got aware of that. I mean, this is coming from the top down,
right,
you know, so
right.
You're going to be associated with that.
And, you know, so many people politically lump Tennessee and Kentucky in together because they're you know, they share a state line and geographically demographically, they're just about the same. But that's not really true. Demographically, they're not the same. Tennessee has some big cities. They've got Nashville and Memphis and Knoxville and Chattanooga. And those are very sophisticated cities. Politically.
Right.
Tennessee is also the home of former vice president and longtime Senator Al Gore his father, Tom Gore, who was a senator before him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is a familial history of a strong Democratic Party there. It went Republican with Reagan and stayed Republican. But Abdus, I think you're right. The demographics are changing, and I think it is possible for a Democrat to win that seat.
I hope so.
Nobody had been really talking about that seat until now when this poll came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republicans have said that they're confident of, in a best case scenario, picking up 5 Senate seats in this election, in a worst case scenario, breaking even, not losing any seats and maintaining a 52-48 majority. Well, the Democrats who are being targeted, people like John Tester in Montana, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, they're actually starting to show some strength. And they're at Joe Manchin is another one in West Virginia, and they're leading in their own polls. So I'm going to lay this on the table. I don't have any idea if it's going to happen or not, of course, but I would venture to say that there is a possibility that the Democrats could win Tennessee, win Nevada with Dean Heller going down because he's actually behind in the polls in Nevada, and then holding the seats that they're defending. I could see the Democrats actually winning back the Senate or splitting the Senate 50-50, in which case the Democrats would have to, you know, try to pull a vote like Senator Collins of Maine or, you know, some other, you know, John McCain, so long as he's alive. So some other moderate. I mean, you can go issue to issue and point at different Republicans, but I think it's actually a possibility.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I do think so, too. And I think that even among not so far right Republican voters, they are pushing for a return to those moderate Republican voices that are the adults in the room that are. And I think that they are willing to vote for. And this is just purely conjecture, but I'm just looking at Dianne Feinstein as an example. You've got Republicans who are willing to vote for Democrats if they're not too liberal.
Right. Especially in a state like California, where Republicans essentially don't have a shot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we're talking about having something like the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee on the table. And that's a frightening prospect for many people, Republicans and Democrats, to have a far right Trump style Republican on heading that committee.
Yeah.
I think that's the foreign policy that more people are becoming aware of in our position on many foreign policy issues like Israel, like China, are coming at like Russia, aside from the investigation.
The Iran deal,
like the
which
Iran
made its
deal.
Way through that committee.
Exactly. These issues are becoming, aside from some voters who are not as aware as we would like for them to be, we have to remember that. Because of social media, people are becoming a lot more aware of issues they might not have known so much about before.
Well, let's talk about that. We only have about 4 minutes left, and we have a couple of other issues we'd
never
like to try to get to. But Dianne Feinstein, she's in trouble in California.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So
yes.
What are you hearing about this primary challenger?
Well,
he's broke compared to her, first of all.
He's broke.
He's
racking up these endorsements, especially in the labor community. And the state Democratic Party voted twice at its recent convention to not make an endorsement, which is a major blow to Dianne Feinstein.
It is. For someone who's been in office since 1992.
Yeah, she's the godmother of the Democratic Party.
She is.
And
that's part of the problem. But aside from the fact that she's been in office for too long, which is something that people are becoming more sensitive to, the fact that she is one of those conservative Democrats that many Democrats, especially younger Democrats, are not willing to continue to support. She's been a supporter of the national security state. She was a supporter of the Bush tax cuts. She actually said of President Trump that, you know, maybe we should give him a chance because he could turn into a good president.
Right. She did say that.
She said that. And even though she has $10 million cash in the bank, and Kevin DeLeon only has 500 grand. So he can't match her.
In a state like that,
that's
you
nothing.
Carry
that's
around 500
nothing.
Grand in your pocket.
Exactly.
It doesn't even buy you a TV commercial.
No. Yeah, especially with their constituents, their district, California 48th, are the wealthier districts. He can't match her advertising, but she can't defend her record.
That's the thing right there.
Right, because, I mean, let's be honest with you. Dianne Feinstein has not been effective. I mean, she's been sitting there. She's been enriching herself. You talk about money. Well, I mean, that's how she's been getting the money. I think her husband is...
He's a very, very wealthy businessman.
Yeah, right.
Tied to
the defense industry. So, I mean, it's... She is one of those ones where I think that the younger, as you said, Jackie, the younger progressives and those in the Democratic Party, they want to see go. I mean, she has stayed there. She's not effective. And I think she even supported the Trump tax cuts, too, if I'm not mistaken.
I think she
that,
may
that
have.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, yeah.
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 Well, in our last minute, I think we have about a minute. I want to talk very quickly about Tim Pawlenty. Tim Pawlenty, a moderately conservative Republican from Minnesota. He was a two-term governor. He ran for president for 5 minutes or so in 2012.
Yeah.
Well, he just announced, much to everybody's shock, that he wants to be the governor of Minnesota again. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that he sees that there's, again, there's forces within the Republican Party, he's one of them, where he feels that he alone can rebrand Republicanism. And I think you see that it's so crazy on the other side. It's like, well, now they want somebody with a little sense. And so what you're going to see now is that all these Republicans are going to be anti-Trump. That's what you're going to see. And I'll tell you another thing, and I predict this, and I'm saying this right here on the show, is that what's going to help change the Republican Party are the money guys. The money guys that are behind these people, you're going to see them say, we don't want another Trump. We don't want another this. And the money guys are going to be the ones to shape the Republican Party, I believe.
And Tim Pawlenty has spent the last 6 years being one of the money guys here on K Street as one of the major lobbyists in town. We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time.
Aww.
I'm sorry to say. We were joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.